When we think of the origins of human-caused climate change, we think of the industrial revolutions of the 18th and 19th century, technological advances that kicked off the burning of coal and oil at unprecedented levels. And when we think of mitigating the effects of human-caused climate change, we usually think of ways of reducing our carbon footprint by moving on to greener sources of energy and changing our consumption behavior. But this story forgets another important change that took place in the last 200 years. In 1825, the planet's human population was 1 billion. In 2011, there were 7 billion human beings on the planet. With the current projections estimating that by the year 2050, the human population will be 9.6 billion, there is a pressing question. Can climate change be stopped simply by moving to greener sources of energy and reducing our consumption levels in the developed world? Or is there something more drastic in order, like curbing the population growth of human beings? Given the grim history of states trying to control their population, could something like that be morally acceptable? And if so, how would governments around the world go about implementing such a policy? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, Sarah Connolly, Professor of Philosophy at Bowdoin College in Maine, and author of One Child, puts forward the argument that in the wake of climate change and the overall environmental destruction, future parents have a moral right to only one child, and that the state should regulate the rate of human reproduction, not only for people in the developed world, but everywhere on the planet. Sarah was in Costa Rica when we spoke, and a storm was picking up as we started recording, so you might hear the sound of pouring rain in the background, interrupted by birdsong when it stops. Sarah Connolly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with the basics. What's the connection between the number of people on the planet and climate change? A lot of people might think climate change has mostly to do with the consumption behaviors of people living in developed countries, the amount of carbon dioxide our activities produce, rather than with the total number of people on the planet. So the average person living, say, in Africa or India might have a much smaller carbon footprint than someone living in the United States. So why focus on the total number of people?
First, climate change, while it is a huge problem, is not the only problem that we are facing arising from overpopulation. Climate change aside, we are running out of all sorts of resources. Mm-hmm. We are running out of fresh water in many places. We are reducing the amount of usable topsoil at an unsustainable rate. We are running out of precious minerals. There are many problems arising from overpopulation. We know, for example, that cities are getting huge numbers of people that they can't sustain, who are living in slums with no facilities. So although climate change is a serious problem, it's not the only one. Now, as to climate change, certainly a lot of the problem with carbon emissions is a function of, well, especially the United States and China, who are the greatest producers of carbon emissions. But to say that doesn't mean, oh, well, that would be easy to fix. What we have found historically is that people have been very unwilling to change their lives in a way that would significantly reduce their carbon emissions. So even though we know that the way Americans live is unsustainable, Americans have typically been unwilling to give that up. So yes, this past year, because of COVID, there has been a reduction in carbon emissions. But that's because of COVID, and that's not because Americans have suddenly become green. So it's very hard to get people to change their lives to reduce emissions, and yet it is actually relatively easy to get them to reduce the number of children they have. Second, as relates to climate change, something like 1.3 billion people in the world live in absolute poverty. We expect and we hope that they will be able to live lives that are not in absolute poverty. But that necessarily means that their carbon footprint will go up. And that's actually a good thing as concerns those particular people. We don't want to fight climate change by condemning billions of people to live in near starvation. But again, it means we need to pay attention to the numbers, since for those people, we actually want to increase their carbon footprints.
Perfect. So we'll come back to that question about whether it's easier or morally more acceptable to try and reduce the kind of resources that some people are using rather than try and just reduce the absolute number of people. But since you pointed out that it's not all about climate change, it also has to do with sustainability. Concerns about overpopulation and sustainability of the planet is an older concern. But also hard to know whether those concerns are justified. So we have, as you mentioned in your book, the example of the 18th century English economist Thomas Malthus, who famously articulated concerns of this kind in his essay on the principle of population. And, you know, those concerns were proven to be, you know, laughably misguided. You know, the number of people on the planet when Malthus was writing compared to how many of us there are now is mind-boggling. So even if we can't see it from our current vantage point, isn't there hope that, you know, politics or technology or a combination of the two might, you know, be able to render our current anxieties about sustainability just as exaggerated as Thomas Malthus's were?
Well, hope springs eternal, but we don't want to rely on it.
Right.
Malthus was wrong. But to say Malthus was wrong, therefore any prediction of overpopulation is wrong, is itself wrong. So in the 18th century, they had many false ideas about medicine. You know, they had false ideas about how to cure a particular disease. But we wouldn't typically say, well, 18th century medicine was wrong, so I guess all medicine is wrong. That doesn't follow. We know more now than Malthus did. And we admit that in just about every field. It's only because people are, I think, uncomfortable with the idea of overpopulation that they go, oh, once someone made a false prediction about this, so we don't need to worry.
Therefore, all, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a poor argument.
It's bad induction based on one case of some past prediction. But let's get to the crux of your argument in your book, One Child, because it isn't only about sort of practical concerns about the future. You're making a moral argument, putting forward an argument about why in the future and possibly even now it might be immoral for parents going forward to have more than one child. Can you say why you think that is exactly?
Yes, I'm glad to talk about that because honestly, the facts are incontrovertible. You can Google them, you know, and see, is there a lack of topsoil? Do we need to worry about our fresh water sources? The moral recommendations are more controversial. So yes, I argue that given the numbers we now have, and that includes, I would say, the very recent drop in the fertility rate stemming from COVID, we don't have a right to have more than one child. Why? Well, this involves us in moral philosophy, but that's okay. We all do moral philosophy all the time. Because the question is, when do you have a right to do something? And usually, if I say I have a right to vote, not just a legal right, but a moral right, or if I say I have a right to health care, something currently debated in the U.S., there are two reasons we might argue for that. One, I might say I have a right to health care because I have a basic interest in health care. I can't live well without it. And a lot of people argue that we have rights to the things we can't live without or can't live well without. So many people argue we have a right to food, for example. Mm-hmm. Fine. I think, as far as my basic interests go, we can have a good life with only one child. We can obviously have a good life with no children. Lots of people do. Some because they chose that, some because they didn't, to have the ability to have a child. But we can obviously have a good life, even if that involves some disappointment. Second, we also at times say we have rights to do some things, even if it's not in our interest, even if it's contrary to our interests. We typically say you have a right to eat unhealthy food. We may deplore it, but we go, okay, if that's your choice, go ahead and live off fat and salt.
It's up to us. Yeah.
And that right is that right is based on autonomy, the mm-hmm. idea that we have a right to choose how to live. Mm-hmm. Great. We have a right to autonomy up to a point. And that point is the point at which my autonomous choices start to hurt other people. Mm. We typically say, I have a right to smoke. I have a right to live off greasy hamburgers because that doesn't hurt other people. I don't have a right to hit you in the face. Mm-hmm. Having more than one child at this point in time is actually worse than hitting someone in the face,
right.
I think, given the facts. So that's why we don't have an autonomy right to have more than one child. We don't have a basic interest in having more than one child. Thus, given where we are now, we don't have a right to have more than one child.
So let me pick you up on the first branch of that, the claim that, you know, one can live a fulfilling life without having children, or at least by only having one child, if necessary. How do we know that? Isn't that a claim that differs depending on the person, the culture that person belongs to, the gender of that person, the age of that person, all sorts of, you know, personal kind of contextual facts that, you know, sure, I might say, you know, I think I can, you know, live a fulfilling life without having children, but how do I know that is true of most other people?
Well, I think we know that based on induction. That is, we all know, I assume, people who haven't had children, some by choice, some not by choice. And in my experience, even those who wanted children but didn't have them for reasons stemming from their employment, maybe, you know, it wasn't compatible, or physical reasons, mm-hmm. they didn't then just lock themselves in a small basement room where they could mourn. They went out and did other things. It's like any other disappointment. Mm. That is, you might be in love with someone and you may feel, you know, my life without so-and-so will be shattered. But if it doesn't work out, typically you go on and you live well. And if you don't, if you spend the rest of your life obsessing about George, whom you couldn't get, we don't go, oh my gosh, the poor thing. We think she needs therapy. You know, there's something wrong with you, which typically we can help if you cannot surmount a disappointment like this. Now, there might be disappointments that are unsurmountable. Maybe, in fact, being locked in a small basement room for life would be an unsurmountable disappointment. But we know people lose both their legs. I mean, it's awful. But as a matter of fact, amputees, after a certain point of time, register that they are as happy as anyone else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I do think it's possible. I think it's especially possible, given that I am imagining not a single individual who lacks more than one child when other people have families of whatever they want, yeah. 6 or 8. We imagine this as a policy, so you wouldn't stand out as being, oh, the guy who only has one kid. You would be normal. And that, in fact, insofar as there is a stigma in some places for having a small family, that stigma would be eradicated because it would be a common condition.
Mm. Interesting. Why one child? Why not? So what you're arguing for is is not just that, you know, one can live a fulfilling life by only having one child. You're arguing, you know, we could potentially live fulfilling lives without having any children. So given the devastating impact human beings are having on the planet and on other animals in particular, you know, why not argue no children, that humans have a moral duty towards the rest of nature to just, you know, piss off, get off the planet's back once and for all?
Well, I grant you, I want the human race to continue. Call me crazy. I think the human race
That's hope, right?
is capable of many good things, has done many good things, and it need not destroy the planet. What destroys the planet is the numbers of humans we have. So it's perfectly compatible with maintaining species rather than eradicating them, with having a healthy environment rather than an unhealthy environment, that there be humans. Mm-hmm. And then we would also have symphonies and plays and human kindness. Mm-hmm. All we need to have both of those things is to have fewer humans.
Right, right. And so the argument goes, A, it's not necessary. B, we would lose out on various other goods if we eradicated humans altogether. Some of the things you mentioned, art, great achievements of humanity, and so on. Let me grant you for the minute that having more than one child might be immoral, and this is something we should think about. This is in the moral calculus of our everyday lives and our big decisions. You know, this is something new that we need to think about. But we think a lot of things are immoral. Maybe it's immoral to, you know, cheat on your spouse or betray a close friend, to lie a lot to people. But we don't really let the government regulate those behaviors. We are uneasy about giving the state the power to be the moral arbiter of our lives. So what's different about this case? Why do you think that the state needs to get involved and impose, you know, sanctions on those who behave immorally in this specific way when it comes to, you know, their reproductive behaviors?
Well, obviously, there are cases where we think the state should not intervene. Just as obviously, there are cases where we think the state should intervene. So we have laws against theft, we have laws against assault, we have laws against murder, we have laws against pollution, not that they are necessarily followed. So mm-hmm. we want state intervention in at least two kinds of cases. One is if the harm is sufficiently great, like personal assault, that's a great harm. We want the state to stop me or to incentivize my not assaulting you by threatening me with punishment. Two, we want the state to intervene when coordination is an issue. So when it comes to something like pollution, if one factory in the whole world polluted, you know, dumped its whatever dirty water into the river, that would not be all that destructive. But we need a system where no factory can do that. And so we need a policy that affects everyone. And in order to have a policy that affects everyone, the way to do that is through some sort of state regulation. So the harm that overpopulation does, or having more than one child does, if we all do it, is very great. And we want to coordinate the efforts. We don't want to leave it up to this person or that person. We need it to be a blanket policy. And that's where the government is useful. Mm.
So as far as I understand it, your thought here follows a version of John Stuart Mill's harm principle, right? So the thinking goes, the state has the right to impose restrictions on our freedom when our behavior harms other people. And you said when the harm is great. And of course, you know, harm is the notoriously kind of slippery concept in Mill. A lot of behaviors can be construed as harm, but, you know, we wouldn't always allow the government to intervene. And Mill ends up defending more or less a version of, well, the harm needs to be a violation of other people's rights in some way. So what rights of others are we violating when having more than one child? It doesn't seem intuitive to me, at least to begin with, what rights of other people I might be violating.
Well, since you know John Stuart Mill, you know that when he says we have a right to something, he actually thinks that a right is a rule that maximizes utility, that is, that produces the greatest welfare for the greatest number. So he's an easy philosopher for me to use, because I would say having more than one child is extremely bad for the welfare of everyone. So I do not have a right to do something which is extremely harmful to the welfare of pretty much everyone in the planet. So that, again, for him, that's what rights are about. You have a right that I not harm you in this way, and I don't have a right to harm you in this way. And unlike lying, which, well, it would actually be hard to enforce the state anyway, but I was going to say, unlike lying, which is a wrong thing, but which typically would not destroy your life, many people think a population of 10.9 billion will in fact be extremely miserable. And that's what we project at this point by the year 2100. Even given that the fertility rates are falling, and even assuming they continue to fall, we'll have an up population, which I think most people think is unsustainable. That is, it'll be miserable for most people.
So can we articulate that, though, in one of the language of the rights that we have? I mean, just saying you'll make me miserable might not be, you know, something you can couch very, very easily in the language of rights. But are we talking about, you know, making it such that some people won't be able to be fed, for example? Is that the kind of, are we talking this kind of extreme?
Yes. I have a right, for example, that you not enslave me. You would agree to that. I have a right that you do not make it impossible for me to get food or shelter or fresh water, especially when that's easy for you to avoid. If it were inevitable, that would be one thing, but it clearly is evitable. And so, yeah, I have a right that you do that. Unless we do wipe out the human population, which is not my vote, there will be people in the future, and they have a right that we have done something not very difficult that would at least allow them the possibility of a good life.
As you say, a lot of the people that write about sort of this topic of reproduction ethics really recoil from the idea of government regulating our, you know, reproductive rights or the rates at which we are allowed to reproduce. And one of the reasons is obviously that the past examples we have of that usually are quite grim and, you know, kind of make us recoil when we think about it. And you yourself obviously draw a line when it comes to things like forced sterilization or forced abortions, you know, practices that are really abhorrent to us. But you're more comfortable with things like financial sanctions. Why is that better? Won't that end up having a disproportionate, you know, impact on poor people? So, you know, if you're rich, if you're living in a developed country and you know, well off, you can afford to pay the fines and have a bigger family if you want, whilst, you know, poorer people have to, you know, stick to one child. Isn't that also somewhat ethically troubling?
Right. So as you say, I am against invading people's bodies as a general rule, and certainly in this case. Happily, I don't think it's necessary. We know that how many children people have is really sensitive to finance. Part of the reason there's been a recent drop in the number of children due to COVID seems to be just that people are worried about money. You know, they lost jobs. They're worried about their financial future. Mm-hmm. And that's not surprising. It's happened previously when there have been depressions or recessions that the fertility rate has dropped. So, yeah, I actually suggest a range of things, including free contraception that's readily available. But as I progress up the sanction ladder, I do come to saying maybe we should have a tax burden for people, an extra tax burden for people for more than one child, or even just a fine. Mm-hmm. So would that be regressive? Would it be unfair to poor people? Obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious, so I will say it. I think just as taxes are geared to your income, so should any fine be. That is, richer people should pay more. Poorer people should pay less. That's what we do with taxes. I grant you, if you have a gazillion dollars, there's a point at which you'll still have an advantage, I assume. I don't think people should have all that much more money than other people do. They do. It gives them certain advantages. So maybe Bill Gates could have as many children as he wanted. Generally, though, I think that the financial disincentive, to put it that way, would be effective and would be relatively egalitarian, because we would scale it to individuals' income just the way we do with other taxes. And I think that would be effective.
You are against, obviously, these kind of more invasive government sanctions, like operations on people's bodies that would effectively make them incapable of having more than one child. That clearly is recognition that that would be a sort of violation of our, you know, bodily autonomy or something along those lines. Couldn't people say the same about the more general restriction? That's also the same kind of restriction of our kind of bodily autonomy.
Paying taxes is a restriction of your bodily autonomy?
Well, yeah, if you made it, you know, incredibly hard for someone to have more than one child, you're you know, in some way kind of restricting their bodily autonomy. I mean, maybe not, but yeah.
Well, there are restrictions and restrictions. So I am against bodily invasion, as they put it. That is, a forced sterilization or a forced abortion, where you literally take someone's body and tie them down or anesthetize them and do something to it. When it comes to actions that indirectly affect what you do with your body, that I think is more acceptable. So we already restrict your bodily autonomy in that very indirect way. In the United States, for example, we tax cigarettes a lot. And we tax them a lot in order to disincentivize smoking. And basically what that means is we try to make it too expensive to smoke. So smoking, it's a choice, but it's a choice that affects your body. And we are trying to get you to do something different to your body. So in your sense of bodily autonomy, we are interfering. That is, there is an influence here which makes it more difficult for you to do something, not necessarily impossible. Lots of people still smoke, but more difficult. We have laws against trespassing. So you would like to take your body into someone else's totally fancy media room and watch a movie, and we say your body's not allowed here. Okay, we live with those sorts of restrictions all the time. Typically, the question that arises is, does the cause justify this kind of restriction? But if it does, I think we are fine with it.
You're listening to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Check out The Philosopher's website for upcoming events in April and May, including this Tuesday's webinar with Shannon Valler in conversation with John Zarelli on A Citizen's Guide to Artificial Intelligence. Go to www.thephilosopher1923.org to register for this and many other events for free. Can I go back to a question that we sort of touched upon in the beginning? If we are going to limit people's freedoms in some way to protect, you know, the world from going down an environmental crisis, why not make legal other activities that are huge contributors to things like CO2 emissions, like industrial farming, like airplane travel? Why not focus on those things instead, rather than something that's so kind of a touchy subject, like, you know, people's reproductive rights? I mean, eating meat and, you know, getting on any number of flights you want in any year those seem even less essential to living a good life than maybe, you know, choosing how many children we should have. So why not argue in that direction? That, you know, I know you said, well, we're not very good at adapting our consumption, you know, but if it was illegal, we would have to. We wouldn't be able to do those things anymore.
Well, I'm actually all for those things being illegal. I think that would be good. Okay. France has just banned short-haul flights, I read. That is, if there's a train that will do the same thing, then you shouldn't get on a plane, and good for France. So I am for that. If it were illegal, we would not do it. It's making it illegal is the hard part. And here again, I am emphasizing to some extent what I actually think is easier. Because again, we have shown that we voluntarily, to some extent, will reduce the number of children we have because the fertility rate has fallen. What I'm trying to do is incentivize that so that we do that more, so that we do it faster. Global emissions have not fallen. Maybe this past year, sorry, but that was an unusual year. So basically, there seems to be more popular resistance, as I said in the beginning, to changing our lifestyles. And why that is, I do not know. You can buy a hybrid car very easily. So a hybrid car is a car that runs partly on gasoline, petrol, and partly basically on electricity. It charges its own battery through the use of the petrol. So it's environmentally a much better car. It's not like a totally electric car where you have to have an infrastructure that allows you to plug it in. So you might think everyone would be buying hybrid cars. They are furthermore, in the long run, cheaper because the engine maintenance is cheaper. But they're not buying hybrid cars. It remains a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the car market. Why? I only can guess because it's different. People find change extremely hard. I don't, you know, that's a fact about human psychology. I don't know why it is the case, but it is the case. But buying a hybrid car, I can testify because I have one. They go just as fast. If you want to, people are always worried about how fast can I go from 0 to 60? Really fast. You know, I mean, it's just a car. But people still don't buy it. And when it comes to being a vegetarian, you know, being a vegetarian would be better for your health. I mean, assuming you are in a place where there are alternative protein sources, but people in the Western world are. So that would be better. Are people flocking to vegetarianism? No, some are doing it. That's great. But for whatever reason, I think the chances of outlawing not just factory farming, but the consumption of meat, I think the prospects are very, very low, even though I think it would be a great policy.
Do you think it's also more morally acceptable to follow your strategy of incentivizing people rather than, you know, have a legal ban and, you know, ending up immediately coercing people to do something?
Sure. People prefer the carrot to the stick. Now, an incentive can be sort of a stick, but what I suggest, again, I suggest a series of measures. So first, I suggest that contraception should be free and readily available. And when I say readily available, I mean around the corner. So you don't have to make an appointment to go see a doctor who can only see you in 3 weeks in order to get birth control pills. I think they should be sold over the counter. That is, you should just be able to get them. I think this should be true everywhere. I think rich nations should help make contraception available to people where it is not yet available. So as we know, a lot of poorer areas, including sub-Saharan Africa, have almost no doctors, much less access to contraception. We could fix those things. So that would allow people who themselves want to have fewer children to have fewer children. That would be a huge first step. And I may mention parenthetically, people in the Western nations are worried about fertility rate drop stemming from COVID. But in the meantime, a lot of people no longer have access to contraception or family planning that did before COVID. So while the Western nations who have contraception are having fewer children, we expect people without, who now don't have access to contraception, to have way more. So who knows how that'll work out. Anyway, so I would start with that gift to everyone. But then I would say, how about a cash reward for people who have only one child? Or if worse comes to worse, how about a fine, a tax penalty for those who have more than one child?
So given that we're talking about, you know, cash and money, I'm sure some people will be thinking, well, is this going to be practically viable? You know, is it going to be economically viable, for example? So in the West, particularly in Europe, we already have this, you know, demographic problem. And there's a question about who's going to pay the pensions of, you know, the aging population of Europe, especially if we're talking about only one person per two people. You know, is this going to be sustainable in a different way? Is it going to be economically sustainable?
I think it is possible that there would be economic changes. So at present, old people aside for the moment, we want for there to be a growing economy. And one way to get a growing economy, well, one way to get it is to produce sort of useless products that you convince people to buy. Another way is to have a constantly growing population. So some economists worry about the economic effect of not having a growing population to keep the economy growing. But requiring more and more people in order to keep the economy going is something Bernie Madoff would have understood. That is, it's sort of a Ponzi scheme where you keep things going now by just getting money from more and more people. And in the long run, it doesn't work. It will be bad for the economy, surprise, if we run out of natural resources. So when we think about what about economic growth, we're really just pushing the burden down the line because their economy is not going to be good if there's not enough food, if there's not enough topsoil, if there's not enough water. So it's very short-sighted to say we need a growing population now to fund us. Okay, two, about old people in particular. Speaking as an old person, I have some resistance to the idea that there's this burdensome group of old people, and how the hell are we going to sustain the old dotterers in their care homes? Old people can be productive. So I don't know about Britain, but I know that, or the rest of the world, in the United States at this point, a person can retire and get a government pension when that person is 62 years old. 62. The average lifespan of an American is 85 years. So if you retire at 62 and you die at 85, that is 23 years on a pension, on Social Security. That's not a good idea. When they came up with this retirement age, people died a lot sooner. Yeah. I think the answer is not to have people die a lot sooner, although when I had talked to university audiences, the students always say, why don't we just get rid of the old people? That would solve it. I think older people could keep working longer, to make a long story short. Some can't. You know, if you have a disability, great. But a lot of people can. We don't like that idea because, of course, I'd love to retire and get a pension. But that doesn't mean that it's a good idea that people live 20 years on a pension. It was meant to kick in when you were basically in ill health. So I think we could change that. I also think, again, we might have to have economic ideas based on what, to a Western perspective, would probably be a poorer standard of life, smaller houses, fewer cars, or no car. Mm-hmm. But I think those are all adjustments we could mm-hmm. make. And failing to see that is, at best, short-sighted, and at worst, just selfish.
What do you see as the biggest challenge in, you know, if we did try and go forward with this plan of yours about only, you know, having one child per... I also take it that you're talking about one child per person, right? Not one child per couple. So if you get married and have a child and then get divorced, that's it. You've had your fair share. You can have another child now with your next spouse, as it were.
So there's a sense in which you would have half a child. That is, you would share it with your divorced partner.
Yeah, yeah, half a child per person. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the biggest challenge? Well, as I say, we have voluntarily reduced the fertility rate, and that usually corresponds to the position of women. That is, as women are more educated and work more and earn more money, they have fewer children. So that part is good. I'm all for women in the workforce, and I'm all for women having money. And women having money also means they'll have more political power, because democracy or not, we know the more money you have, the more political power you have. So one challenge would simply be improving the position of women around the world, which is a thing to do regardless of demographics. I think we want women to be equal. We want women to be able to work, to earn as much money, to have the same political power that men do, not just in the developed world, but everywhere. That's a difficult thing to do. It is a challenge, but it would be extremely helpful. Another challenge is just education. A lot of people don't know these facts. They're not familiar with, you know, they sort of know the environment is in danger, but they don't know all the specific facts about population. So I think education would be a good thing, and that should start in elementary school, grammar school. It's not really that complicated. But that leads us to the third challenge, which is politics. Unfortunately...
Right. Who's going to sell this policy to the electorate?
Yeah, it's of late, and this is especially true since the rise of Donald Trump and people like him, like Bolsonaro, for example, that a lot of people aren't assessing policies in terms of the facts, but in terms of who is endorsing them. So if a Democrat in the United States endorses it, then someone of the opposing party, which for us is Republicans, tends to go, oh no, I don't want to do it. We know in the United States that even wearing a mask, which is good for you and good for others, became political. So we see this politicization in a lot of places. And that's a challenge, that people don't look at the facts. They look at their political party and whether their party has endorsed it.
Yeah. I was going to say that there's a special challenge in the US that likes, especially the US right, that likes to couch everything in the language of rights. And I can't see someone convincing US citizens that it's not their, you know, fundamental and, you know, born right to have as many children as they choose.
And the US is important because we are such big polluters. Our children are doing more harm than are the children of people with a smaller carbon footprint.
And do you see any downside to following this policy? So is there anything that worries you that, you know, of course, now it seems a million miles, you know, from where we are, that something like this would actually get implemented in any one country. But, you know, if suddenly tomorrow someone told you, yeah, this country is about to start implementing this, would there be any concerns that you would have? What would be the things that you would look out for?
I do think we have to be worried about the class aspect. That is, we do have to make sure that it's an egalitarian policy, that those who have more money aren't able to buy their way out of the policy. And that's not just true of this policy, that's true of most policies that are basically good policies. So that's an issue. But aside from that, no. Sometimes I talk to people and they'll say, but I have two children and my second child, Alice, is the light of my life. And if I imagine life without her, it would be a desert. Of course, when you have children, you love them. And to imagine your life without them can be devastating. But that's not the relevant question. The question is how you feel about your unborn child. Like, how much do you miss that child? You don't. You're very attached to the children you have, whom you've raised, whether you had them biologically or adopted them. You're very attached to them. But we're not asking you to kill your children, for God's sake. We're asking you not to have some children. And those aren't children to whom you are attached. So no, I don't think there's a real downside.
And my final question, what would be a book that you would recommend to listeners on the kind of issues that we've been talking about today around the ethics of reproduction and the relationship between that and the climate change question?
Oh, gosh. I would recommend my own, naturally,
of course,
which is called One Child, Oxford University Press. And so Naomi Klein is not talking specifically about human overpopulation, but she addresses the effects of that. So her book is called The Sixth Extinction, I believe. So that is useful information.
Sarah Connolly, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. It was fun to talk about. I'm sure everyone is completely convinced, which is easy because it's just true. This is what we should do. Thank you, and see you later.
This episode is part of our mini-series on philosophers on climate change. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes on Why There Is No Solving Climate Change with Tom Brooks and on Planning the Green New Deal with Alexander Douglas, look them up on your podcast feed. If you like listening to this podcast, help us spread the word and leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Next week, we'll be talking about the role of race and racism in the Anthropocene. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again next week.